This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Steve Schooner. Steve is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. Steve, welcome to the show.
Great to be back.
Steve, I understand you professor that for that academic world. You get to do a lot of travel. You've been on the road a little bit?
Yeah, so the summer tends to be the opportunity where we have more time for travel. And we've been doing increasingly over the last decade or so what we tend to think of as law transfer, working with other governments and improving their procurement systems. And one of the things that really struck me when I first started in the academy, I had come straight from OFPP, was that it is remarkable how when you're trying to explain how another country should work on their procurement system, you really stop and think a little bit more about why we do what we do. Not so much how, but the why. So trying to explain what you do often makes you stop and think about why. And I found it incredibly instructive. So in any event, you know, as you were saying, so since classes have been over, I've been to the United Kingdom twice for two different reasons. We were in Morocco and I was in Italy. But it does strike me every time we talk to other governments, you always learn something new. Based on some of the themes that you and I had talked about for today's show, I think there's three themes that I want to mention that I've been thinking about since my last few trips that we can kind of work into our discussion today. The first is, and this will make sense to most of your listeners. Most governments, particularly the developing countries, they begin with a focus on corruption control. So they create their whole procurement system around trying to stop people from taking bribes. So that's one. And so, of course, they get very, very heavy-handed. And we'll come back to why that's good but not so great. The second, no news to anybody listening to the show, it's all about the people. And we'll talk a lot about that one later. But the one that's really been striking me recently is that most governments, and ours is included, aren't very good at metrics, measuring how we do in the procurement system. And so, you know, lots of things to talk about.
Yeah, and, you know, on that last one, it's interesting because, you know, we've been having conversations, you know, about that just generally, you know, within the procurement community. And metrics is hard. To me, it's an extremely challenging area to try to figure out how you're going to measure.
But one thing that's really been exciting the last couple of years is Frank Kendall over at the Defense Department, as part of the Better Buying Power 2.0 initiative, you hear DOD talking seriously about metrics these days. And I think this conversation is really a good idea.
Well, why don't we, you know, segue to the, and we can start sort of have these themes, but let's talk a little bit about Better Buying Power 2.0. It came out, to your point, there's a lot of discussion and rhetoric around, you know, thinking and also metrics. Right. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
So first, I think we've come a long way on better buying power. I mean, I don't think it's any secret to anyone that a lot of the community, and I put myself in this boat, we're not terribly impressed with Ash Carter's original initiatives in Better Buying Power 1.0. I think it was in many ways fundamentally offensive to the private sector. It was openly hostile. But I think that they've come a long way towards refining the message. And what I think Frank began Better Buying Power 2.0 was by saying, look, we've been working at this for a while. We've learned a little bit. We've evolved. And now what we really want to focus on is effective implementation and making things happen. But let's talk about the metrics just for a second, because I think it's really important. In the United States, we've historically measured three things. Now, there's a fourth thing we used to measure. We don't measure anymore. I mean, you're old enough to remember. We used to judge procurement officers by how many transactions they pushed out the door.
Right.
Obviously, this is a stupid way to do business. Mm-hmm. But the three big ones that we focus on now is we focus on price, you know, the price in the original contract. And of course, that's an obsession with the lowest price.
Right.
We tend to focus on delivery timeliness. You know, what was the delivery date in the original contract? And then the other one, of course, is the original performance spec. And, you know, I think you've heard me say this one before, but let me just use the example I often use to Congress. If I ask you today, do you know whether the original B-52 contract was delivered on time, under budget, and did it comply with the original performance specs? The shorter answer is you don't know and you don't care, because it was one of the most valuable procurements that the federal government ever engaged in. It was great value for money, high levels of customer satisfaction, exceeded everyone's expectations. That's
still,
what matters.
Still, and it's still flying today, right?
Right. Okay. Right. So, but this is interesting. You know, it's all about low price. So what have we seen in Better Buying Power 2.0? There's a critical discussion in 2.0 that we didn't see in 1.0 about LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable.
Right. And that discussion is, you know, when is it appropriate? You know, to your point about thinking, it gives some thought to the idea of when is low price technically acceptable appropriate, or when you should use best value, and what are some of the measures around that, and either, you know, identifying what best value should or shouldn't be, and how much the government's willing to pay for greater performance. And all those things are in there that weren't there before.
Right. I think this is one of the most critical issues out there now. Everyone sees that the government's using more LPTA, and there's a fair amount of debate as to whether that's a good idea. I'll just offer you the story. All my students have heard this over the years, and they laugh about it. But I tell the story that when I was a sophomore in college, it was a Thursday evening. We're in the dorm room, and a crisis beyond your imagination occurs. The blender breaks. Okay. So we run down the street to Sears, and I'm there with my then roommate and good friend, who's now a professor at the University of Virginia Medical School. So we're not talking a particularly dull guy here. So we walk into Sears, and there's an entire row of blenders. And I immediately go to the end of the row of blenders, and I pick up the cheapest blender, and I feel a hand on my shoulder. And my friend Tom says, "Schoon, we're too poor to buy cheap."
Okay.
So we went to the other end of the row. We bought the industrial strength blender. And when we graduated, it was still working.
Like the B-52, right?
Exactly, right? So sometimes you have to pay more for better value. And there's a lesson in that.
Well, I have to ask, do you still have that blender today?
So I think we left that one for our roommates when we graduated.
Right.
But my wife has a really nice blender.
Okay. That's important, right? So Steve, where do you want to go? You want to talk a little about the corruption issue, going back to the themes a little bit, or anything more about better buying?
Well, I mean, the one thing I really want to focus on and give Frank Kendall a lot of credit with Better Buying Power 2.0 is the rhetoric is just plain better. So for example, if you read the memo that came out a few months ago, the first thing that Frank said he wanted everybody to do was think.
Yes.
Okay. Isn't that wonderful? We all know we have plenty of rules, but if we can get our acquisition professionals who are supposed to be exercising discretion, taking advantage of all this Dalwea and Klinger-Cohen training, if we can get them to think about business outcomes, not just checking boxes or getting the lowest price, I think we could really make some serious progress out there.
Right. And again, to that point, you know, that short, that one-page bullet list of the highlights of it, the very first underneath the title of Better Buying Power Initiative is there, this admonishment to think, or these are tools to help you think.
Right. But let me go back to the metrics just before we leave that. And again, Frank's made the discussion more sophisticated now. The two metrics that I think are the most important in public procurement that we don't talk about enough today are customer satisfaction and value for money. Think like a consumer. Remember, all procurement is the government engaging in consumer activities. When you go into the marketplace, when you walk into the grocery store, when you buy a laptop, when you buy your car, you're not thinking about lowest price technically acceptable most of the times. You might be willing to buy the generic can of peas on the shelf, or you may not be brand sensitive when you're purchasing milk out of the refrigerator case. But as a general rule, you're making conscious decisions about being satisfied with the money you spend. It is remarkable to me, with all the data that we have in the world, that our government still is almost fully resistant to any kind of customer satisfaction data. So think about it. If you've flown internationally, particularly through Asia in the last few years, Steve Kelman talks about this a lot, but I think it's great. When you walk up to a customs desk in Asia now, you're standing in line and you notice off to the right, there's a little machine and it has three buttons. There's a smiley face, there's a sad face, and there's something in the middle. And it takes you 1 second, but all you have to do is indicate when your experience going through customs or immigration, did you think they did a good job or not? It takes 1 second. But they're constantly getting data. Everything we learned about industrial psychology from 50 and 60 years ago is if people are being studied, they perform better. If you're thinking about metrics, that's great. When you buy a car, you get a survey from the auto manufacturer.
Right.
You take your car in for survey. They say in for service. They give you a survey. This just makes sense. The government can do this kind of stuff.
Right. And, you know, Steve, right now we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Steve Schooner. Steve is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And we'll continue our discussion of these themes. We'll turn to, you know, corruption prevention and what Steve has
said. People, people.
Oh, you want to do people next. That's fine. That's great. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. Steve is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And Steve, when we took the break, we're about to turn to people as our second theme.
Always an important topic
in
procurement.
Yes, absolutely. So, and there is, the acquisition workforce, obviously it is about people. You know, you can have all the rules you want, but if you don't invest in people and have quality people running the system or, you know, negotiating the contracts or dealing with the private sector, you're not going to have an efficient and effective system.
Right. I mean, I think if we've learned anything in the last 15 years, it was that when in the 1990s, when we didn't invest in the acquisition workforce, and in fact, when Congress was involved in cutting the acquisition workforce, that was a really bad economic decision. I mean, I think that we've learned from that. There's a couple things that are really important on that. I think the most important thing that we learned during that period, though, was that if you had enough people to award the contracts, but you didn't have the people to manage the contracts after they were awarded, that was really penny wise and pound foolish. So we've got much better rhetoric on that. We have much better policy from the top. The unfortunate thing is that we're probably not going to be able to do the kind of hiring we need. So let me just say two things about this quickly. First, we are not alone on this. So around the world, we are one of the few countries that at least thinks about managing contracts after they're awarded. One of the weirdest things in global public procurement is in most nations' legal systems, procurement ends when the contract's awarded, and what we call post-award contract management isn't considered procurement, and so nobody thinks about it. That's obviously an unmitigated disaster. But all governments suffer from not wanting to spend enough people to manage the contracts after they were awarded. Now, let me just say one quick thing about better buying power. So, as many of you know, after the Ganser report a few years ago, DOD realized that they had a real problem, and they committed to hire 20,000 new acquisition professionals.
Right, yep.
And they were working on it, right? And for all appearances, they hired at least 12,000, maybe 13,000 new people. Now, granted, there were people retiring at the same time, but they were on their way to backfilling quite a bit. Unfortunately, with sequester and the budget problems that we have, around Thanksgiving, at the end of last year, Frank Kendall acknowledged that the Defense Department was no longer planning to try to make that big reinfusion. So we are still looking at the same situation we had before. We have an aging workforce. They weren't hired to do the kind of work that we need them to do. They're overworked, they're overwhelmed, and frankly, retirement eligible. So we've got a legitimate crisis, and it's not going to go away.
Right, and retirement eligible in the midst of furloughs, right? Sequestration. It's just that, you know, life is not getting any easier,
right?
For the first, the civilian workforce and for the entire workforce.
Look, and I don't want to just preach to the choir here, but I have to say, as a former federal employee and as a taxpayer and American, I am totally offended by the whole furlough business. You know, it's pretty clear that we can find other ways to address this problem. It's incomprehensible to me that our elected representatives in Congress receive full salaries for not doing their jobs, not dealing with the budget, and basically having civil servants pay the price. I think it's absolutely patently offensive.
Well,
so let me go to a different approach. Let me say something good about.
Well, Steve, first of all, that's why I have you on the show, man.
Okay, so one really interesting thing, if you think about our acquisition workforce, one of the strengths in the United States is we are leaders in the professionalization of the acquisition workforce. So you all know about DAWIA, the Defense Acquisition Workforce Improvements Act. Clinger-Cohen Act brought the same requirements basically to the civilian agencies in 1996, but we've always believed in the independence of the contracting officer, training, and the like. One of the things that really strikes you when you travel around the world, particularly when you're dealing with developing countries, is who the people are in procurement and how they got there. So two things, and these, one won't surprise you, the other might depress you a little bit. Particularly in certain regions, okay. A lot of the people in public procurement are basically relatives of high-ranking political officials who weren't smart enough to get a job somewhere else in the government. So they just got stuck in procurement. So the number of senior public procurement officials who have said, oh yeah, my uncle or my father or so-and-so has this job and I got put here. So that's really frightening. We at least have some kind of a merit system in the United States. But let me go to the more important one. Stop and think for a second about what kind of people end up as senior procurement officials in countries. And what you often find out is that they're basically government specialists. So they might have degrees in public policy or public administration. They've got background in government. But guess what they didn't study in school? They didn't study business. They didn't study economics. They know absolutely nothing about markets whatsoever. What I always use as my litmus test is if I'm in a room with a bunch of government officials, I love to throw out the term market research to see how they react. Very common to get the 1,000-mile blank stare. What do you mean by market research? Whoa.
Right.
Okay. Really scary stuff. So in any event, the idea that we have people who know a lot about government and how government works, but don't know anything about private industry, don't know about markets, and frankly, aren't very good at negotiating, that's really problematic. So I think we've done a pretty good job at least trying to professionalize our workforce, but around the world, that's one of the things that they're really struggling with.
Right. Well, you know, from, you know, just thinking about our workforce, we do have, I still think that's an issue with our workforce too, understanding how business operates, understanding how markets work. You know, is there something that you would point to further do?
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing, and we talked a lot about this in the 1990s, and we even tried to get it in the statute, and we failed. But it seems to me that the single best thing that we can do for our government public procurement officials is get them rotational assignments working for contractors in the private sector. The problem is our conflict of interest laws are so draconian, and Congress is so obsessed with this hypothetical revolving door nightmare that it's impossible to do this. The joke among senior people that study this field is that nobody should ever get the draft or request for proposals until they've written a proposal. There's a certain logic to that, right?
There's absolute logic to that.
So think about it. How do I know what to ask you to tell me if
you haven't done it yourself.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So that whole conversation. So I think these are really, really valuable. I was very lucky. I had the opportunity to do government service, go to the private sector and come back. It was incredibly valuable to me. And the number of former government people who, when they retire, go to work for a contractor say, wow, if I had only known this way.
Oh, I say that all the time. Right? About my experience.
So if we could do rotational assignments, the interesting thing is, this is very, very common in everything except procurement. It just makes a tremendous amount of sense. I think we can come up with ways to do it, and I think that if we were creative about it, it would really be excellent. Now, let me say one encouraging thing. You know, we can talk about Gen X, Gen Y, and the younger generation. One of the great things about the young generation is they don't feel tied down. So, for example, my father had two jobs basically in his life. He was a career Army officer, and then he went to a large multinational corporation, and then basically he retired. I have students who are under 30 who've already had six jobs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I actually think that this cross-fertilization is going to work pretty well for them. But I do believe that one of the hardest things as a government official, particularly a busy government official, someone who's got people looking over their shoulders and saying more, faster, it's really hard to learn your industry and your trade. And that's why organizations like NCMA, the National Contract Management Association, are so important. Get out there and meet people in the private sector. Talk about what you do, see their experiences, and that's really how you grow.
Right. And so it's great, some great observations, Steve. And you know, one of the issues, we're just coming up close to the break, but in the context of people, one of the things I did want to talk a little bit about is the role of management in the procurement process, and especially in light of a recent GSA IG audit report on raising issues about management intervention in the procurement process.
Right, this whole balancing act between management versus oversight, and particularly audit and prosecution, is a huge issue.
Right, and we'll do that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and my guest, Steve Schooner. He is the Professor of Government Procurement Law, Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. You're listening Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. Steve is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And Steve, when we took the break, we agreed somewhat that we would go on and talk a little bit about the GSA IG audit and in the context of people and slash the issue of oversight and identifying areas of abuse. The GSA IG audit report focuses on what the IG concluded was improper management intervention in the procurement process, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I'm gonna go backwards, and then we'll come back and talk about some of the specifics of this. But I did want to go back to what I basically started with when I was talking about what I've seen with other governments outside the country. And we fall into this trap in the United States too. It's very easy for legislators to decide that the single most important thing in procurement is controlling corruption, okay? We don't want anybody to engage in fraud. We don't want anybody to take a bribe. We don't want any money to be misspent. Well, let me just be clear on one thing, and I've said this testifying in front of Congress more than once. If you want a public procurement system where there is no fraud and no mistakes, all you have to do is stop awarding contracts, okay?
Right.
Because if you have no contracts, none of them will be imperfect. Okay, now right. The question is, how are you going to balance this? If you create a draconian regime where you are so focused on controlling errors, it is impossible for people to exercise discretion, make good business judgments, and frankly, evolve and think about the customer. So this is the big trade-off. There's nothing new. Now, the GSA example is a good one, but as I was saying to you earlier, I think that the real issue here is that we've seen this play out at the Defense Department with the DOD IG and the Defense Contract Audit Agency as well. So I'll let you steer it in whatever direction you want, but I think it's really an important moment in terms of thinking about oversight and basically management.
Okay, well, why don't you talk a little bit about the DOD experience, and we can go from there. I mean, I like the theme, the idea of balance. To me, that's fundamental. The system has to be balanced.
Okay, so the system that I grew up with at the Defense Department was the Defense Contract Audit Agency, and people will actually find this funny if they're under 30. The Defense Contract Audit Agency actually used to support the contract function. So if you were in procurement, you use the audit agency to help you make better business decisions. If you were litigating against the contractor, you would use defense contract audit agency auditors as expert witnesses in litigation. So they were part of the acquisition team. Their purpose was to make good business decisions for the federal government. Well, look, something went wrong in the last few years. Now, in all fairness to DCAA, their workforce got cut badly. And one thing that we could talk about later is their backlog, which is literally mind-boggling at this point. They are so far behind, and that's one of the reasons we see so many cases arising now with regard to statutes of limitations, but it's going to be years for them to clear the backlog, and there are a lot of pathologies that will come from that as well. But the key thing here is, when you think about auditors generally, think about private sector auditors, you know, big five audit firms in the private sector, what you want your auditor to basically be doing is providing an independent check on everybody's work. So you want independence. Unfortunately, what's happened in the last few years, and much of this was driven by Senator Claire McCaskill, who has really been leaning hard on the Defense Contract Audit Agency, is the audit agency understands that their number one priority is to find contractor errors and refer them for criminal prosecution. That's a very, very different task than anything
else.
Right,
than providing, you know, right. you know, business information to support business decision making. It is a completely different
right.
task.
Now, add on top of that, you've got an agency that was for a long time understaffed. You've got basically all different kinds of responsibilities. In addition, they've done a lot of hiring recently, so they've got a lot of junior people. Here's where it really gets scary. There's a lot of relatively junior people doing audits at the Defense Contract Audit Agency. They have been discouraged from engaging with the contracting officer and the contract function, and they think that it's their responsibility as soon as they see a problem to run and tell somebody so that there can be a prosecution. That's not the way you resolve problems. And frankly, they don't understand the nuances of the contracts well enough. This kind of brings us back to the GSA IG situation. Now, let's be honest. IGs are a little bit different from pure audit instrumentalities, but we've also seen a lot of evolution in the IGs in the last few years. Some people would say the IGs have become more militant. Some would say the IGs have become, unfortunately, a little bit more focused with reading about themselves in the newspapers. And it does seem that today the inspector generals are less interested in helping the agencies function effectively and more, just like everyone else, more interested in finding, in collecting scalps or notches on their belts. Look at all the fraud I found. Look at all the people I sent to jail. You know, I don't really think that that was the intended purpose. The goal behind the IG was to have an independent internal source to make the agencies function as effectively as possible. Now, the situation that you see at IG here, I think what you were talking about earlier, Roger, is this fundamental issue of when the IG sees a problem, what should they do? Should they work with the agency to resolve the problem, or should they basically just basically bring the hammer down? I think what we'd like to see, particularly in the contracts function, is a free-flowing conversation where the contracting officers, senior people in that chain, can make good business decisions for their customers, all of which brings us back to a very simple thesis. Auditors can't run agencies. The auditor's job is not to fulfill the mission. The IG's job is not to fulfill the agency mission. It's to find, identify, and resolve problems. The IG doesn't buy things, the auditors don't buy things, and they don't run programs. They're there to second guess and criticize. So if they have the power to trump the operators, you could see a situation where the agencies literally simply couldn't do their jobs anymore.
Yeah, well, along those lines, so it sounds to me it's almost like you know, I'm hearing a lot of things in that. I mean, to start peeling back the onion, but it's almost like the issue of balance, and it almost goes back to where you've described DCAA and even a little bit the GSAIG and the audit report is, goes back to your earlier comment, you know, if you don't want any fraud, you wouldn't award any contracts. If
exactly.
All their job is to do is to identify those issues and report them, if that's what they see their job is, then, you know, it's in a certain sense that grinds the system to a halt or makes it much more difficult to execute.
Right. So let's analogize to GAO. Okay. So the Government Accountability Office writes lots and lots of critical reports. There's no question about this. Okay. But one of the things that they're almost always trying to do in those reports is recommend how things could be improved. And interestingly enough, GAO doesn't direct people to do things, right? They make suggestions. That's a really good function.
Right. And another thing that sort of I'm hearing too is, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it, is there a sort of a conflicting roles with, you know, providing operational support and audit as a business advisor versus and also having the same oversight function.
I think this is a terrific point. I think that it was not so many years ago that we could have seen the audit agencies doing these different roles. I mean, any organization can have divisions and different functions. You can have the audit agency providing guidance to the contracting officer. You can have them serving as expert witnesses in litigation. You can have them referring fraud and the like. But I think what's happened is, given the staffing and the backlog, I don't think that the audit agencies in the government right now are well positioned to provide that kind of independent, helpful advice. They basically see themselves as a hammer in search of a nail, and I fear that the IG is moving in that direction as well. That's really a shame, because the audit and oversight function is tremendously important, and if people can do that, be creative and constructive, then government's going to perform better. But just having a lot of people walking around with a hammer is not going to make anything work better.
They're just looking for nails, right?
Exactly.
Steve, we do have to take our last break. But when we come back, we'll continue this theme, talk maybe a little bit about the Suspend Act.
Sure.
That's floating around out there. But my guest today is Steve Schooner. He is Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Shouldn't a workstation live up to its billing? If yours are no longer working, there's Initiate from the Han Company. Initiate workstations are easy to order, install, and reconfigure. Components fit precisely and provide endless ways for space planners to arrange people. Initiate is also highly sustainable, helping reduce your environmental footprint. Initiate workstations, inspired by the practical needs of the workplace. Online at Han.com. That's HON.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. Steve is Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And I got that right every time I said it, Steve.
And we appreciate
so far,
it.
knock on wood, I got one more time to go at the close of the show. But Steve, when we took the break, I introduced the thought of, well, I think we've covered the IG and their role sufficiently for one show or one segment. But the Suspend Act, I know, GW did a program on it about a week ago, focusing on it, suspension and debarment in this proposed legislation to sort of reform how it's managed. I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, really an interesting thing. I think the first thing I'd want to say about it is, from having talked with the staffers who put a lot of thought and work into this, I think that they were extremely well-intentioned in their rationale for why they were doing this. And this is really important. The one thing that everybody sees is that Congress, every time they get frustrated now with a contractor, they come up with another rationale for a mandatory debarment. And so the laundry list of reasons for why a contractor can be immediately mandatorily debarred has been growing. And I think everybody agrees this is a bad thing. It's a bad thing for a bunch of reasons. First of all, no customer should cut off their nose to spite their face. Second, right. Suspension and debarment were intended to protect the government, not to punish. And I think those are the big ones, but
Plenty of avenues to punish people, right?
Exactly. So we got plenty of sticks. So what's interesting is when you look at the statute, different things jump out to different people. I think that the main thing that jumps out to most people is what they see is on the civilian side, not so much on the defense side, there would in effect be a tribunal that would be involved in basically overseeing civilian agency suspension and debarment. And it looks like the idea would be it would end up at the General Services Board of Contract Appeals.
Right.
And the IT community, of course, remembers the old Brooks Act and when they had protests in the 1980s, but we're not going there.
Yeah, I remember that too. It was quite painful.
All right. So the interesting thing is there is a resources story here, and then there's some side story. The most interesting statistics that the staffers talked about at our program last week is that the civilian agencies spend twice as much funding the suspension and debarment operation as the defense agencies, but they end up suspending and debarring fewer than half as many firms. Now, one thing that could mean is that the Defense Department is just far more quick and vicious, but I don't think that's the case.
No, I don't think so.
Or it could mean that the civilian agencies have too many people running around with suspension and debarment hats on that basically aren't doing very much. And frankly, I think this is the primary criticism from Congress. Congress can't believe...
It's government duplication, right?
Well, but that's one of them. But Congress can't believe that there are civilian agencies that spend a lot of money in contracts that aren't constantly suspending and debarring people. They think it's the natural order of things.
Right. There's many, many bad actors out there, right?
If you're not suspending and debarring people, something's wrong. Right. Now, that's pathological in and of itself.
It could be Congress, right?
but let's go back to the other big data call, because this is really the one that I think is the most controversial issue. People look at the suspension and debarment data over time. Oh, let me say one other thing. Almost everybody agrees that one of the problems with thinking about this legislation is most of the data that's been analyzed is old. Okay? So there's a long lag time, but a lot of the data on suspension and debarment is a few years old, and things have changed in the last couple of years. But when most people look at the data, they immediately come to two conclusions. Number one is large multinational firms that are household names do not get suspended and debarred, no matter how bad they are. Okay? That's not really true, but that is one conclusion. The other is small businesses get suspended and debarred all the time, and therefore something must be wrong with the system. All right, let me go to the second one first. It is true. Small businesses get suspended and debarred far more frequently than big businesses. This is for a number of reasons. I think the two most obvious here is that first of all, let's look at the big businesses first. First of all, the government needs some of those big contractors more than they need any individual small business. Put that aside. In addition, the large multinational corporations spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year on compliance programs.
Yes.
Their compliance programs are bigger than the small businesses that just got suspended and debarred. The other thing is, how many times have you heard the story of the new entrant into government contracts? I got a small business. I may have gotten it through a simplified acquisition. Then I got a bigger contract. I was too busy. I never hired a general counsel. I never did the compliance training. I didn't really have any managers. Oh, and then something went wrong. And gee, that's not really my fault. Well, no, sorry. That's the problem. So unfortunately, for better or for worse, there are a lot more small businesses that get suspended and debarred. And frankly, unfortunately, there's good reasons why a lot of them get debarred. Remember, the government's just trying to protect itself from having to do business with firms that cannot meet the standards that are expected in terms of the large government contractors. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the board just for a second. You know, one of the interesting things about consolidating the suspension and debarment system is that, remember, any individual suspension or debarment official at any agency can suspend somebody government-wide, okay?
Right, yeah.
So, for example, somebody at a small civilian agency could suspend Lockheed Martin or Boeing or General Dynamics or Northrop Grumman over a relatively small contract. Well, there is a history and a regulatory preference for coordination among the agencies so that the primary customer gets to make this call. I think that makes sense. Whether making this more judicial and putting it at a Board of Contract Appeals is a good idea, that's where it gets a little bit more complicated.
And I think that's where we've heard more concerns and from the community as to, you know, does it make sense? Does it create a sort of a framework that becomes more and more litigious or litigation-like?
Right. And I think that's a legitimate question. Now, the flip side to this is, historically, suspension and debarment is incredibly discretionary. The agencies do it differently. A lot of people fear that it's a black box. And in all fairness, when the big contractors get involved, oftentimes there's a threat of a criminal prosecution, a civil false claim, and they're entering into a global settlement, which is typically going to be done, at least in part, under seal. So nobody knows exactly how that process worked or what happened. And there's a lot of individual contact, often involving high-ranking officials, knowledgeable attorneys, and the like. One of the arguments for doing this at a Board of Contract Appeals is that it would just simply be more transparent. The flip side to that is a lot of people fear that if it's more transparent, that it's going to escalate and the problems aren't going to get solved and we're going to get bad results.
Right, because often it turns into, frankly, what I've seen, a negotiation between the suspending, debarring activity official and the contractor of, well, here's the corrective action I'm going to take. Here's how I'm going to address these things to ensure that, you know, that I've got a system in place to prevent what happened previously, and they work it out.
Right.
I think, in, you know, to balance in the interests of
protecting the government.
Right, exactly.
Right. So corrective action is a great term, but the critical thing here is that almost any time a suspension or debarment is threatened in conjunction with a criminal prosecution and a civil false claim, the outcome is going to be a negotiated multi-year compliance program. There's often a third-party monitor brought in.
Right.
There is high-level training, often at multiple levels, often at all facilities. There are periodic reports from the third party to the government.
Yep.
And frankly, look, these are expensive solutions. But this is the way that the government protects itself so that it can continue to do business with a valued provider while ensuring that these types of mistakes don't happen again.
Right. And you know, the issue about this, the board, and it becomes more transparent, it does become, I think, more difficult to negotiate, because then part of it I'm thinking here too is that you've always got someone looking over your shoulder.
Right.
Right. And, you know, someone looking over the shoulder of this board is like, did the government get a good deal or not? And it doesn't make it more difficult in the long run.
Right. But in addition, the real question is whether it would change the standard. Remember that the standard for suspension and debarment is very similar to that of responsibility. The whole goal here is to give the contracting officer discretion to determine whether this vendor is one that the government should rely on.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing for a judge. Now, many of you know that some suspension and debarment cases periodically end up in federal court, but those are a very, very limited sphere, and they tend to only deal with issues like de facto debarment, where someone's been stigmatized or they've been tarred and feathered or something like that. Those are very unusual cases. As a general rule, the government gets a tremendous amount of discretion, which is one of the reasons why the contractors work so hard to try to work these things out. They're willing to invest heavily in compliance regimes, and the interesting thing is often after the fact, they build on those compliance regimes, and that becomes something positive for them in terms of marketing efforts.
Right. It becomes part of their business, you know, their business framework, and they do use that in talking to other customers, right? So, and Steve, yeah, we could talk about this. It sounds like we could talk about the Suspend Act and suspension and debarment, you know, for an entire show, but unfortunately, we're at the end of the show for today. So I want to thank my guest, Steve Schooner, Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.